Chatter on books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. We are live and in person on a Monday night at Caddy's on Cordell, which is the, David Aldridge, keep me honest in this, it's the premier sports bar in the DMV, right?
It is definitely the place where the pretty people go to drink and watch football.
It has outlasted all others.
All others, and I'm not sure about pretty people, because this is my local bar, so...
I don't know. We've seen some good-looking people in here already.
They allow me to stay.
There you go.
That's
great.
Really the way it works.
There you go.
So thank you to Caddy's. Thank you to Ronnie. Thank you to Lisa for making this happen. And by the way, if you come into Caddy's on Cordell any day of the week, any time of day, Ronnie, who do you know him, Ronnie is sitting at a chair table in front of the bar. It's like watching King Henry VIII.
Oh, he's
People
he's the man.
Come in, and they're in line to pay tribute. They bring him swag. Last week, somebody was giving him jars of salsa for some reason when I was here.
Okay, that's random.
And I had to wait 15 minutes respectfully before I could go up and kiss the ring.
Can we do a shout-out for Ronnie?
We could do an absolute shout-out for Ronnie.
Sure,
Ronnie could not care less about us.
Ronnie,
look at him.
Ronnie, give Ronnie.
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 The chairman
Ronnie.
Of the board.
Ronnie.
Woo. There he
is. Okay.
Always compliment.
And since we are live in person... To my left, the most important person here, Claude Jennings. The rest of us could leave this evening and the
exactly.
show would go on, but if Claude left, we'd be in trouble. To my right, David Aldridge, an icon in his own right.
I don't know about that,
yeah.
but thank you.
Damar Smith, who we're going to talk to for a long time about his fabulous book, Turf Wars, which is about so much more than football, right, D?
A little bit more.
A little bit. And S.L. Price, Scott Price, author of... You know, I say it's in my all-time top five, Scott. It might be in my all-time top three books now.
Wow.
Playing Through the Whistle, not his more recent game, The American Game
Correct.
Book, but Playing Through the Whistle, great book. Thank you guys for all being here.
Oh, it's awesome.
This
Thank
is
you
fabulous.
For having me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fabulous.
I'm sitting in between royalty.
Exactly.
I don't know about
royalty.
That.
Again,
right.
royalty.
Okay,
Stop.
As I warned Dee, we like to do randoms. I like to do randoms and pop-ups and things that may or may not have anything to do with books. A couple of weeks ago, David, Claude, we were together, and we were all saying we had just learned the day or two before about the NBA cheating scandal.
Oh, yes.
And we all kind of calmed ourselves down and said, let's not get all wrought up about this. And I'm shocked gambling is going on. How do we feel about the baseball gambling scandal?
About the same, right? Like,
really?
I don't know how you put this genie back in the bottle. I don't know how. Now, they're trying to cut back on some of the prop bets, I guess, but they're not eliminating prop bets. And until they do, every sports league has a major problem because prop bets are completely easily manipulable. Is that a word?
It's a good word.
It is a word. I made it up. It's just very hard to get rid of them. And it's very easy to bet on something that really doesn't affect the outcome of a game.
Okay, but a baseball player is sitting in the dugout,
yes.
right.
and he is texting people
yes.
who are going to bet on what he does next. That, to me, seems a little...
Not good. Not good. It's on SportsCenter as we
speak. There we go. We're so timely.
Not good.
D, put it in context. NBA scandal versus... MLB scandal.
Look, I think it is simply the sign of things to come. With full transparency, I did several gambling deals with the NFL Players Association, licensing and marketing deals with DraftKings, Fanatics, and a few
sure.
others. But I think it's going to be the one existential problem to sport. And I think the problem is going to be this issue of resiliency. How much does it take before people start to believe that all the games are fixed.
Right.
And I think it's much lower than we think. Right?
Yep.
So I'm worried about it. I think the commissioners and union heads and ADs need to change the policy. I think the NCAA coming out a couple of weeks ago and saying that it's okay for college athletes to bet on pro
crazy.
Games is dumb wrapped in dumb with dumb filling.
Absolutely crazy.
And I just think that if they're smart, they would understand that every enforcement effort is going to reinforce that the game's
yes.
fixed.
Right. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And that's the spiral.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, I have a personal thought, but Scott, go.
This is the biggest change in sports in my lifetime.
Gambling.
There is nothing that has come close, and I'm talking steroids or whatever, that has affected
100%.
Our game and our feeling about sports. This was the third rail in sports forever since the Black Sox scandal, and now sports has embraced the third rail and is being blown up and electrified by it in ways they didn't expect.
Okay,
and my biggest problem as a media guy is, who's going to say it's bad for sports?
100%.
I'm talking about the media. I'm talking about ESPN. Yeah. Right. I'm talking about the New York Times.
Because they're making so much money off it.
I'm talking about people who have made gambling deals with, you know, deals with gambling companies because it's been media is in an existential financial crisis.
Sure.
And they needed this revenue stream. And are they going to call out their partner and say, you know, gambling's bad for sports. We can't have this in sports.
Right.
They're not going to do it. So that's to have that not even on the table.
Right.
And I understand sort of the justification for, yes, if you therefore make it legal, then we're in partner. We're going to learn about, like, the underside of the game. But it is also giving permission. You are giving people ideas they never had before.
Absolutely.
And there is no bulwark against it. And the media was part of that bulwark.
Right.
As were the commissioners and the sports, which D, you have, you know, insight in that we don't.
Okay, so next question, I promise it. We'll very quickly get to Dee's book, because it's fabulous.
It's okay. This is a much better conversation. Let's just keep me out of it.
Keep
me out of it.
They're all related. And now, Scott, we'll start with you, and then do Dee, and then David.
Yes.
In terms of impact on sports, this is a bigger crisis than, say, doping.
100%. Oh, 100%. Here's what I told a group last week, and it was a college group of people. By the time the college group of people watching sports are my ripe old age, and by the way, your ripe old age. So
we're all at a plateau here.
I'm right now.
What percentage of college kids are going to think when they get to be 50 that the game is fixed?
Yeah,
sure. I'm surprised it's not more.
Look. Yeah. You look at college. The rate of college gambling on a college campus is something like 65%.
Sure.
So again, going back to this resilience thing, I mean, I don't want to bring up a morbid topic, but, you know, four planes went down in 9/11 and nobody flew. You know, when we all remember the Tylenol scandal.
Sure.
And four or five people got impacted and nobody took Tylenol anymore.
Right.
Months. Yeah.
The rate that it takes to destabilize the authenticity of sport is much lower than anyone thinks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to David's point about never putting this genie back in the bottle, because I try to be cool, so we hang out with our 20-somethings and our now 30-something, and early March, February, early March, we go to Vegas for the first 2 days of the Final Four, which is just the greatest thing. It's the early days of the best. And you rent out these tables and these chairs, and you're hanging out with somebody, and the number of prop bets they make is just breathtaking. Yes. You can't even, I'm like, are we watching the, no, oh, we wait, there's the color of the shoe that scored the point. That is never going, this is just second nature to them. Yep. It is absolutely second nature to them.
And to Dee's point, look, what hasn't been discredited in American life over the last 50 years? Government, church, family, all that has broken. The authority. Sports is sort of our last place where everybody can get together, and we've always said that this is our religion.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't it break like everything else has?
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
That's right.
No, there are a few shared moments anymore. Dave, you were in the show where you were talking about. Remember the Coldplay couple? The Coldplay couple busted.
Oh yeah.
At the,
Wow, that took a turn.
It was a shared moment.
Shared moment.
It was.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was where's this going?
Absolutely love those.
No, it's right.
They couldn't buy a suite. Come on.
Look at this.
I know. Look at this. You can do whatever you want. But you'll see.
Maybe a pair of sunglasses.
Exactly. And that too.
So you're a one of these commissioners. You're head of baseball. You're head of basketball. You're head of football. What do you do? If anything.
I'm
shocked.
Well, no, because, Adam They're Silver not. Wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, so I don't think he's shocked encouraging gambling to be enhanced in 2014. So I don't think he's shocked that gambling is going on. All you can do is the one thing that they can get Vegas, I think, to cooperate with is prop bets, because that's just the lowest hanging fruit for a voracious segment of gamblers. You're never going to stop big-time gamblers from gambling on sporting events. But what you can do is keep, like, to your point, college kids from spending all of their money on whether the third-string quarterback gets in a game and throws a left-handed touchdown pass or, you know, some insane thing that they're doing now. And if you do that, you can at least get the worst of it out. And you can make it harder for gamblers. Like, whether it's – football's a little different, but not really, just because they only have 17 games. But basketball's got 82 games. Right. Hockey's got 80 games. Baseball's got 162 games. That's 6 months, 7 months of players being exposable and vulnerable to being targeted by gamblers. Okay. It's game after game after game.
Okay, these the two baseball players they're focused on, weren't they working with $15, $20 million contracts? How much money were they making off this?
That's the problem. The problem isn't that there is a straight line between the amount of money that they're going to make from gambling and the amount of money that they're already making in the sport. Yeah. The dopamine is the problem.
Right.
And to your
point,
I'll make a bold prediction.
Go.
I think Roger and Adam Silver are going to lead the charge to change this.
So Roger calls you up, D, and asks for advice. Because we've got to talk about the Roger D relationship.
Hold on.
And we're so close.
We're so close.
I was just going to say, how many times has that happened?
He's going to call up.
Yeah. Usually it starts with an F-bomb.
And he's going to ask your advice, and what do you tell him?
I think he and Adam realize that they could go down in history as the two commissioners at the helm who ruined sport. And I think both of them
Scott, you're shaking your head yes.
I think they're at a point in their lives where they've done it, and they're thinking about legacy, and I think the advice is like that. I think they're going to regulate prop betting. I think they're going to reverse the NCAA rule
You have to.
Look, the only reason for that to happen, and again, as someone who signed these deals and now... I'm not saying I regret it, but I signed those deals.
You did. Yeah.
But here's the reason, the only reason I can think of why the NCAA agreed to do this. So that hypothetically, Texas could do a deal with DraftKings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
And then Arch Manning could do a deal, an NIL deal with DraftKings.
Right.
He can say, as he's walking out onto the field on Saturday, that my money is on Chicago, San Diego, and blah, blah, blah on Sunday.
Yeah.
And here's the pull. They can pay Arch Manning in money, but they can also pay Arch Manning in gambling chips.
Sure.
So now you're going to have a pro athlete who theoretically could owe money to a gambling company.
So great. Okay, here's the really important question.
I think they're going to put an end to that.
Here's the really important question, then we'll get to Dee's book, which is fabulous, Turf Wars. And every time you mention the name of a book on a podcast, somebody buys it. It's like every time you hear
Turf Wars.
A bell ring,
Turf Wars,
and Angel's Wings kind of thing.
There you go.
Claude, as the chief financial officer of Chatter on Books, would DraftKings make a deal with us if we allowed as many prop bets as possible?
What would the prop bets be?
The prop
for
bets
us?
Would be how many times does the author speak in the first person singular? What else? Well, there could be many, many prop bets. How many times do we mention the name of the book?
Correct.
Which we could totally.
Absolutely. We're in.
Wait, are you talking about Turf Wars? Is that the book you're talking about?
Turf Wars, America's favorite book.
Can we just go to tequila shots? How many tequila shots?
Okay, quick story. Then I swear to God we're going to go to Dee's book. Many years ago, as David and I think Claude know, my dear friend Mary Madeline had a dreadful public affairs show on CNBC, I think it was.
Oh, was it Equal Time?
It was called Equal Time.
Oh, yeah.
And it was Mary and a Democratic counterpart, and they seemed to disappear every few months. And so they'd call me up, and I swear to God, it was $700 a show, which at the time was a lot of money. And I would fill in, and we would have a great time. And sometimes it was politicians, and we hated them, and often it was authors. And she and I would always read the books ahead of time. And we would decide ahead of time if we liked the author. We didn't care about the book, but if we liked the author. And by the way, important note, Mary and I were both extremely pregnant at the time. And if we liked the author, no matter how bad the book might be, we sat there during the entire show with the book on our pregnant stomachs. And if we didn't like the author, the book would just go face down. There you go. So you could do a prop bet on that.
There you go.
Okay. Dee Smith.
I'm not pregnant, so.
Okay, Dee, we're going to talk so much about Turf Wars and that it is about so much more than football, but listeners to Chatter around the world love the backstories. You are a DMV product.
Yeah.
Born, bred. Tell us
born
about
bred.
That.
Born and bred. Born in D.C., Savannah Terrace.
Which hospital?
Washington Hospital Center. Nice. I take that back. Freedman's Hospital.
Wow.
Before it became
Howard University.
Howard University Hospital.
Wow, nice. Okay.
My mother was a nurse there.
Yeah.
Went to a segregated nursing school at Freedman's. So
Dad
I was
a Marine?
There. My dad was a Marine, and today is the 250th birthday of the Marine Corps, so
happy birthday. We've got one in-house.
There you go. There you go.
There you go.
Happy birthday. And grew up in Prince George's County, went to Riverdale Baptist, then became an assistant.
Wait, little sports in your life.
My high school football coach actually works at Stroh Snyder's down the street. So
awesome. Wow.
I see him at least once a month, and we just sit around.
Stroh Snyder's is, for those of you listening, to the DMV, what Caddy's is. Stroh Snyder's is to hardware stores, what Caddy's is to sports bars.
Right. Yeah.
And the best thing about Stroh Snyder's is, and they had a name for it, but guys like David would go in there on a Saturday morning going, I've got a do-it-yourself project. You know, I'm going to fix that, you know, pipe underneath the sink.
I've said this many times.
I don't do plumbing.
But no. It was also...
You don't want to work in a building that I designed. I just tell you that right now. That would be bad.
But there were always repeat visits. But Scott, you live nearby.
Oh, and you go into Stroh Snyder's and you try and stump the Stroh Snyder's.
Can't stump. Yeah.
You know, where's this light bulb? You know, I don't think I've ever... They know where everything is, every bolt, every nut, every lawnmower, every grass.
People
seed.
Are wandering in going, what the hell is
what
this?
Is this? Yeah.
This is the
here?
Worst book
what
thing of all time.
We're going to get to Turf Wars because
we're running out of time, but swear to God, we're going to get to the book.
Okay.
So, but wait a minute, Dee, what did you want to be when you were five? You wanted to play football?
Sorry?
What did you want to be when you were five?
You know, I really thought that I wanted to be a preacher. I come from a long line
in
of Baptist
family.
Preachers, and I went to college, and that phone never rang. So I became a lawyer. And then,
come on, wait a minute. That's a hard turn. That's a hard turn.
Let's not
what
make
it
that really hard a turn. I mean, that's not... Yeah, that's. Let's just keep it in the family. I mean, thanks, Corey. Yeah, I got to go see my dad tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah, by the way, my mother's birthday is tomorrow, 92
Happy birthday,
years old.
Mom.
There you go.
92.
Woohoo!
My dad still thinks the whole pastor thing's going to work out one day.
Exactly.
So.
It still could.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's not an age on that.
Turf Wars.
Nice. Okay, speaking of law school, UVA Law School. Woohoo.
Wahoo wah.
Okay, son went to Wake Forest, now UVA at business school. At the game the other night, Wake Forest.
Oh,
Dustin,
yeah.
UVA, man.
I know.
That was awesome.
I know.
I was really bummed.
This seemed like a really good idea a second ago.
Yeah. You know the only thing I pay attention to on the weekends now?
What's that?
I want somebody to beat Bill Belichick and UNC.
Ah!
Oh, that's...
And it makes me so sad when they don't.
He's figuring it out.
Okay, back to D. UVA Law School, they had you back in 2015. And I think, I got this off the interweb, but I think it's accurate. In your commencement speech, which was lovely... You said self-made is a myth, and therefore we have a duty to reach back, pull up, and provide a foundation so that hard work can actually make dreams a reality. It does obligate each and every one of us to make the same investment for someone else. Maybe a little bit of your guiding principles and why you went to the NFL Players Association instead of...
I felt it was a calling. And, you know, you meet a number of NFL owners who like to believe that they're self-made. They were all born on third base, but they had to...
And thought they hit home runs.
Yeah, 100%.
Love those people.
They've hit a triple every time. I just think that Turf Wars for me, I wanted to write a book that I thought nobody else would write. And I don't know many people who've sat down with 31 billionaires. I don't know many people who've...
David.
Not at one time.
But
it's the juxtaposition, and I think for good and mostly for bad, I think the National Football League has become the cultural epicenter of America.
Yeah.
And I really do believe that for good and mostly for bad.
Okay, hold the point for a second. Scott, you're saying yes.
No,
you
no,
think
I,
it is
I,
a cultural...
I,
as
I,
the author of The American Game,
yeah,
which was about lacrosse, and if you and Dee want to arm wrestle right now for the title of The American Game...
No.
It's okay.
I think both... I'm
both
one of these
true.
Complicated human beings who can hold two opposing ideas in my head at the same time and not go insane, which is... it absolutely is America's church at this point, the NFL.
And obviously, in terms of viewership and interest, there's no other sport that comes close. Probably no other leisure activity. I mean, but my contention in my book, which we're not here to talk about, is that lacrosse is a reflection and a mirror on the entire country, which includes 1,000 years of history that goes back and includes the Native Americans. That I would argue that the NFL does not include that history, 100%. Nor does it reflect sort of the appropriation of land and the metaphor of the game being taken from the Native Americans. So anyway, I think both games.
But now.
Oh, and we're not going to fight over it. I mean, Alex.
Who would win that?
My trump card is his son doesn't play football. Oh, yeah. Dean's son played lacrosse
and played really well at Maryland and PLL. But we could have a prop bet if the two of you arm wrestled.
There you go. Yeah.
We are making money on this show, man.
I'm the first one to cheat.
Yeah, exactly.
Step on his foot.
Yeah, whatever works.
But I like just to see Tori just try to stir it up. Like,
I know.
Exactly.
You know, we're
conflict, baby.
Friends, and, you know,
come conflict. On. We want to get canceled on Chatter. We want to get canceled because that'll be the best thing that ever.
We can do that in 30 seconds.
Yeah, we can do that.
Exactly.
Okay. But you.
Trump is on the cover of the book.
What's the name of the book again?
It's Turf Wars.
Yeah.
Turf Wars, the fight for the soul of America's game. Okay, compare what was so different. I mean, I felt like, Dee, reading this book, you learned so much as soon as you got on the job. Like, you kind of thought you knew what you're doing, but you got in and went, holy cow, this is so different than what I thought. And you spent a lot of time studying the other leagues to see how they represented their players. Can you do, like, the CNN headlines version of comparing where the NFL was at the time and the players versus, say, NHL versus MLB, etc.?
Well, if you remember, post 2009, the NHL had just gone through a brutal lockout.
Lost a year, and they
lost a year. The owners crushed the players. They hired the same law firm that was representing the National Football League to try to crush us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you look at that frame analytically as a lawyer, and I see a lot of my friends from Latham and Watkins out here, my former partners.
Welcome.
You know, the analytical
You're
way to
buying.
Look at it, yeah, they're all, yeah, yeah. It's Turf Wars.
Turf Wars.
It's Turf Wars. Yeah. And, you know, but the straight line analytics was, I don't want to be flippant. I didn't want us to be the hockey players.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so looking at, you know, some of the things that they did that I probably wouldn't have done, understanding that the owners were playing for keeps. You know, when hockey, you were there, you were all there.
Yeah.
When the hockey owners came out and said, we're willing to miss a whole season, hockey fans were like, there's no way.
Absolutely.
Right.
And they did. And they did.
I remember during that lockout, I talked to somebody who owned an NHL team. And I said, I don't understand this. You're losing so much money. And he just started laughing. He said, what are you talking about? I'm making money.
100%. And you know, that, getting your head around that was just one of those existential moments of you know, we did obviously a massive press tour. And I think that was the first time I met you. And, you know, there was a lot of your colleagues who kind of shared that thought of the NFL will never lock out for an entire year based on how much money they're going to lose. But they never understood that if they just got back 2 percentage points, they were going to make money for the next 10 years. And so, you know, when you deal with a group of people who are willing to lose billions so that they're willing to make tens and hundreds of billions, it's a different ballgame.
You know, as somebody who's a good amateur sports fan, I thought I kind of had a sense of the money. No sense of the money. No sense of the money.
No, the league will do $25 billion this year.
Yeah.
I mean, the players will get 12, which is great.
Which is good.
But when you think of, you know, two collective bargaining deals amounted to more than, will amount to more than $300 billion.
Yeah. Okay, Roger Goodell has a big role in this book. as he did in your life. And I was trying to think of great rivalries, and I was thinking of teams, and then I was thinking of, like, Hamilton
Sharks
versus Burr. I was thinking, like, who do we like in, you know, I mean, who would you liken your rivalry to? Two rivals that have to spend a lot of time with each other.
You know, easily Duke, Maryland.
There you go.
You know,
I mean, I'm a hardcore Maryland guy, as you know.
And I'm a North Carolina guy.
Duke, Carolina?
That's good.
Everybody hates Duke.
Everybody
hates
Michigan,
Duke.
Ohio State?
Everybody.
That's correct.
Everybody. Michigan, Ohio State, another good one, but everybody hates Duke.
Of course, I'm giving a lecture there on Thursday, so. Sometimes I like some of the people there.
Here's
the respect for Duke. If you're listening.
You
do? I do. I have a grudging respect for Duke.
Okay, here's the only reason to like Duke. Only reason. It's Coach K. And Coach K, among other things, he was wonderful to, NC State coach ESPN, give the greatest speech. Right.
Yeah.
He was a wonderful friend to him. But more importantly, Coach K had one of these incredible moneymakers, the summer camps for little entitled kids from the DMV. Who, when they're 10 or 11 years old, think that they're going to play for the NBA someday, right?
She goes hard.
They think they really believe it. They're going to make it, man.
I work really hard.
And they got to go to Coach K's basketball camp. And now the only thing sadder than their little aspirations were their parents, who also thought, yeah, my little kid who's going to St. Albans is going to play in the NBA someday. And so you take your child down to this camp for which you paid just enormous sums of money.
Generous.
And the big lineup is, they line up to get registered and everything else. And here are the 95% of the kids who are on meds. They've got a longer line. If your kid's not on meds, it's a shorter line. And then the only time they let the parents be there, which I really respected, is what's the name of the Cameron Indoor Stadium? Is that the
Cameron Indoor Stadium?
That's the first big thing where the kids are all on the floor.
Yeah.
The parents get to sit in the stands, and Coach K comes down to impart his words of wisdom, in which they're going to explain to these 10-year-olds how they're going to play for the NBA someday.
Yeah.
No. He goes, "Let me tell you what this week is going to be like, boys." He goes, "You're going to take a shower." And kind of a stun comes over it. And like the parents, who I swear to God, their parents sitting in the stands taking notes. Like they're going to write down what Coach K is going to tell their son, right? You're going to take a shower. And they're looking up going, what is this? And he goes, you're going to take a shower every effing day. And you're going to use soap all the time. And you're going to change your clothes. Everything. It was a speech on hygiene.
Yeah.
And by the way,
as a mother who
failed in many, many, many aspects, including hygiene among my young sons, it was a game changer. I was throwing money at this man going, thank you, bless you.
Shut up and take my money.
Shockingly, none of the kids in that group ever played for the NBA.
Once again, the mean streets of Bethesda.
All right, can I ask a question about turf wars?
Sure. We hate UNC too, but sure.
Yeah.
I want to do more Coach K.
No, please. Less Coach K. So F. Scott Fitzgerald, once said, the rich are very different than you and me. You talk about the owners as a group and sort of, good one. The rich are very different from you and me. And Hemingway sort of sneered at him and said, yeah, they have more money. But you... We're surrounded by, that's what I want to know. Is it just numbers? Because not only were you around billionaires, but you also were around players, some of them, who did come into money.
Yeah.
And so my question
is... At a very young age.
And we are now dealing with billionaire culture. Yeah. Zuckerberg, Elon, everything else.
Right.
What does money do to character? What does money do to people? You saw where the bullet hit the bone more than anybody.
I joke around at what I'm about to say, and it's been a punchline over the last few months, but I've always described the NFL owners as the worst people I've ever met, and I was a homicide prosecutor for 10 years. And honestly...
Tell us what you really think.
No, in the book I don't pull any punches.
Not a one. Not on a single page.
I think that the worst thing that I can say about them... is how utterly indifferent they are to everyone else's lives. And it's just they don't have to live it. They don't have to experience it. They don't have to see it. They've never been sort of on the other side of dealing with a gender problem. They've never been on the other side of dealing with a race problem. They've never lacked the ability to hire the best doctor. They've never been able to not make it to work on time because they never use public education. They have public transportation.
So, just for one second, this is one of my best lines ever, is that when the Jets were going to move to the Meadowlands, going to leave Shea Stadium and go to the Meadowlands, and Leon Hess said, I don't get what the big deal is. It's only 10 minutes longer than if you were going to the Shea Stadium. To which Howard Cosell says, that's true. If you own a helicopter.
That's a good line.
Yeah.
And true.
And by the way, for those of us who know, that was a great impression right there.
That was good, Dave. Very good.
That's kind of who they are.
Yeah.
One of the things I left out of the book, so no Twitter, You know, there was a rather infamous meeting that Michael Rubin from Fanatics arranged between myself and Robert Kraft to try to save the 2020 deal. And we're waiting for an hour for Robert to show up, and he's one of the owners that I was the closest to. And the fight was the players wanted a $200,000 raise in league minimums. Mm-hmm. And 70% of our guys are on league minimum.
Mm-hmm.
So $200,000 is huge.
A lot of money.
We're waiting for 45 minutes. Robert doesn't show up. Hour doesn't show up. Hour and a half doesn't show up. Ruben finally calls him, and Kraft is in a cab.
A cab?
A cab. Because he woke up and his driver had gone somewhere else.
Right.
And he just got in a cab and he said, take me to Michael Rubin's house. And the cabbie's like, well, I, where does he live?
What's the address?
Who's Michael Rubin?
And Robert says, near the water. This is true.
Excellent.
And so we're waiting for him as he's literally driving around New York looking, and he gets out of the cab. He has a wad of hundreds,
yeah.
And just, you know.
Them off.
Did he ask the cab to wait, or did he say, yeah?
No, we let the cab. Yeah.
So Robert Kraft is Ted Baxter.
Yeah.
Okay, you want my Robert Kraft story?
You have, I'm sure.
David, have you heard this one?
No.
Clyde might have heard this. So, you know, if you hang around long enough this in town, everybody calls you up and says, don't you want to do X, Y, or Z? So over the years, different people call me up. Don't you want to do X, Y, or Z at the NFL? I'll be like, yeah, sure, I'll talk to anybody. Scott Lewicki. You guys know Scott Lewicki?
Yeah. Scott Lewicki.
Love Scott Lewicki.
Yes.
Like him.
Yeah.
Hockey guy and football guy. Anyways, somebody says, go talk to Kraft out at Gillette Stadium.
Stadium.
I said, sure. It was the middle of summer. Very hot. And I'm clearly not dressed appropriately for a job interview because I didn't really carry it such, and it was a sleeveless dress. This starts to get a little sketchy. Anyways, I walk into his office. He was on time from ED. I don't want to just...
That's where you rank.
But I walk in. He's behind his big desk. His office was kind of schleppy. There's like stuff all over the place, but it wasn't... All over the wall, but it wasn't neat and orderly.
Oh, no.
It was like kind of
a mess. No, it's just thrown up.
So I walk in. The first thing he says is, whoa, you work out.
Oh, hello.
Here we go.
I do. And I said, sure. And he goes, what do you do? And I said, well, a little Peloton. Oh, he goes, I do Peloton. He starts to talk to me for 5 minutes about what he does on Peloton. And he goes, I have a trainer that helps me with Peloton. Now, the essence of Peloton, for those of you who know, is they're the trainers.
Yes.
Well, he had a trainer, to Dee's point about money, right? He had a trainer who helped him train with Peloton. He has the trainer on speed dial and hits the trainer up on speed dial so I could hear the trainer tell me about how hard he worked out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then it was like, thanks very much. Off you go.
Welcome to my world.
There you go. Other than they had just no sense of reality, was that the hardest thing in terms of negotiating with them, against them?
That sense of reality just makes them think that every player should just be thankful for being in the National
that
Football
That clearly
League.
Came and through.
Play
yeah.
And play for free.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my line with all of the draftees the 2 days before the draft, and we would have them, and I will just be blunt, it was an indoctrination session for the draftees. We just tried to drill into them what it was like to be finally working into the National Football League. And my line was constantly, the league is going to tell you that you're in the family, but none of y'all are in the will.
And, it's a great line.
You know, and I would probably be a little bit more salty with my language.
Yeah.
But you're not.
Yeah.
And so this perpetuation of you're part of the family, you're a Jet, you're a Giant, you're a Charger, you're a worker. They're going to cut you the day they think that somebody else is better than you.
So what's the average length of an NFL
career?
3.3 years.
That's correct.
Is that still it?
With 100% injury rate.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. So if you think about the twin pillars that govern sort of the union, it's I don't care who you play for. I don't care whether you're Tom Brady or and he's dreamy, by the way, or the backup, you know, or the backup long snapper. Man, all of you are going to fit in between these two pillars of a 100% injury rate, and you're going to play for 3.3 years.
Okay. Speaking of pillars, I thought reading this book, the two pillars of you. You think about your legal career, and you think about being a prosecuting attorney and going after some of the meanest, most horrible people who have done terrible things, and then you're defending some people in your NFL job. Can you talk a little bit about that? I'm thinking in particular the Watson stories were really compelling.
Well, Ray Rice.
Ray Rice, yeah.
You know, some of the best friends I've ever had were public defenders. And if you think about such a small world, Michelle Roberts, who ultimately went on to run the NBA Players Association, we tried murder cases against each other.
Wow.
So
I could see that.
The idea of you know, doing your duty to represent somebody in a system, and I represented them in the collective bargaining system, wasn't that complicated. What was complicated, though, is, you know, look, when you see the Ray Rice video, you know, that prosecutor part kind of, you know, that little bit of a dog comes out of you.
Yeah.
Because you've put people in jail for doing that.
Yeah.
And so you do have to separate the horror of it from what your job duty is. Mm-hmm. I did become, you know, again, I did become more wound up against the league because, you know, when we're getting into a system like that, you know, my only goal with the league is, man, just tell the truth. You know, as a prosecutor, mm-hmm. I got the truth, you know, and if I don't have a good case, you dismiss it.
Right.
And if I don't think I can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, I get rid of it.
Yeah.
With the league, it was always, let's just figure out how to staple this guy to the wall.
Right.
And then we will engineer whatever facts we need mm-hmm. on the front end to get there. And I found that to be more of an anathema to me as a lawyer than anything else I had to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I have 95 questions, but I've got to shut up soon. David, Scott, Claude, I hate having my back to Claude. This is really awful. I know every woman in your
Can
life,
you stand
Claude.
Stand in front of her with some semaphores, please.
it seems to me, Dee, like the job took its toll on you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And to my wife, who's here, our 34th wedding anniversary was yesterday. Nobody put up with more than her. It took a toll. You know, I thought that I was rather invincible taking this job. You know, I came from homicide, and you convince yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you go,
this can't be so hard.
It can't be so hard. And then one day, you know, you're on that fifth martini and the half bottle of wine, and
okay, there were a couple of scenes.
There was always good
wine. There were a couple of scenes in the
script.
No.
There were a couple of good scenes in the book, D, which have got to be part of the Netflix series to which we will be invited for the premiere, which is part of the price of entry of Chatter on Books. Trial attorney drinking games where you talk about the thing that surprised you most, or once you were in Palm Springs pounding, I think, martinis.
Where's
talking
Dave?
About the NHL.
Yeah.
Were you margaritas? Were you part of that?
By the way, this is an advertisement for Caddies.
Yes.
The person I was drinking those margaritas with is in the room.
How many hours?
They were this tall.
And did you see the light? Did you figure everything out?
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. First, we're so handsome. I think if I had to pick the drinking game of thing that shocked me the most.
Yeah.
I was stunned that at the end of the book, and you've all done books, and I've never done them before, and there's a little bit of it. You've done more than I have, but there's a little bit of it that I will never do it again.
Well, Scott does them really well.
I did one
horrifically. David did one successfully.
That's pretty good.
So,
well, you know, there's it comes in together at the end in pieces.
Correct.
So I would say that the best drinking game shocker was that Roger Goodell came out better at the end of the book than I ever imagined, which is a stunner.
Yeah.
It was. It makes you read till the end. Because every other page was like...
Every
other page was...
why was that stunning? Why was that stunning to you? You knew what you thought about him. No, until you started writing, you like did not really understand what you thought about him?
You look at everything that happens in sort of episodic moments without the narrative theme.
Right.
And... I was juxtaposing the first day I met him at the caucus room in D.C., mm-hmm. where he was imperious, just a dick.
Can you tell the story about the pin?
Oh, you want to? I can tell the story.
Yes,
about the pin.
Please do.
So
it's
the
great
first
story
time
in the book Turf Wars.
We met. Yeah, we
Turf Wars.
We met at the caucus room in downtown D.C.
It was owned by a bunch of fat cats,
including Tom Boggs.
Yes,
my former boss. And. We meet there, and of course, you know, I get there early. Roger comes in with a phalanx of security, you know. Okay, yes, I'm from Prince George's County, but I'm probably not going to beat you up. You know, probably not.
But there are probably...
Not today.
But there are a lot of other people who would like to kill Roger Goodell on any given day. So
we're at... You know, we have a lovely lunch, and we've never met each other before. And he, you know, at the end of the lunch, you know, is just sort of... He's very magnanimous. He's just, you know, just very sort of this, you know, this... And at the end of lunch, he reaches up to his lapel, and he pulls off the NFL shield pen, and he says, "Welcome to the NFL." And I took the pen and said, "I'm never going to be a part of the NFL," and slid it back to him.
This is such a great moment in the Netflix series.
And he looked at me like I was absolutely insane. Mm-hmm. Just insane. I just think that for him it was one of those mental incongruent moments.
Yeah.
But then fast forward... I mean, if we put that on sort of one book in, I don't know if you remember, we were in COVID, and he ended up giving a press conference from his basement.
Right.
Oh, that's right.
Remember?
That's right. With the fireplace.
Yes. Yes.
Looks like Alistair Cook.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so odd. It is. So,
did he have a little sweater on?
So he had a sweater, and he did not have an ascot. That's an inside joke. It's an inside joke for my wife, which I'll pay for a little bit later. But... You know, he gives this press conference, and he says, "We got it wrong about Kaepernick.
Right.
I got it wrong about the players who were kneeling. The NFL has to do better."
Wow.
And so, you know, you could look at those two things as episodic, but when you end up writing a book, you know, the theme that comes through is, and I write a lot about his dad. And,
interesting. Yeah. I knew a tiny bit about the backstory, but it's fascinating.
His dad was a senator.
Yeah. His dad was a pro-civil rights, anti-Vietnam senator who took over Bobby Kennedy's seat after he was assassinated.
That's right.
And then was the first Republican senator to take on Nixon.
Right. He took a stand and suffered for it.
Yeah.
They crushed him.
Right.
Yeah. They crushed him. So, you know, I would like to say that I was learning that because I was interested in history. I will be dead honest. I was learning that because I was just trying to figure out a way to manipulate Roger.
Yeah.
I mean, just being blunt. It's what we do.
Again, combining your previous life and your legal career.
Research.
God bless everyone who helped Dee's legal career. Research, understanding everything about the person across the table from you.
Yeah.
That was a huge, consistent part of how you dealt with this.
Well, and his father is, especially now, his father is literally... like almost a romantically
courageous
figure.
Yeah, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington
when
type.
When you juxtapose him against...
George Romney. You know what I mean?
Took
a stand on principle.
Yeah. And took a beating.
Yep. Okay, I've got a really good... But David goes first, then Scott.
No, I nominally cover all sports, but I cover the NBA a lot more than I cover the other sports. And every time there's a labor agreement, it amazes me. It just stuns me. That it is so easy to peel off dozens of players.
Yeah.
That, and it's only 450 players in the NBA. And I go, you guys can't stay together for three weeks? You know?
Eight guys who matter.
Right, and only eight guys who matter on every team, right? Yeah. And you're dealing with, what, 10 times as many players? It's just... The book goes into great detail about how the league is just surgical and how it just picks people off. And I just, like, explain to people, like, it's not Norma Rae with a sign over her head saying union now. That's not how this works.
No. No, it's a little ugly. It's a little ugly.
Very hand-to-hand combat.
It's hand-to-hand combat. I mean, there's roughly 1,900 active players at any given time. But I do have some advantages, and I would say this, compared to basketball. Most of our guys are four-year guys.
Yeah.
So they all come into the league at 22, 23 rather than 18.
Yep.
And I know that probably doesn't sound... For anyone who doesn't have a son, that doesn't sound like a big deal.
Big deal.
For anybody who has a son...
The mom in the group is going to push back just a little.
Yeah.
Not a huge difference between the 18-year-old and the 22-year-old.
Oh, no. No, there's not. Oh, no. Yeah. Nobody's Einstein.
Or the 60-year-old. Or the 60-year-old.
But that that last 2 years is a big deal.
Matters.
That was number one. But number two, I do think, going back to the pillars, I do think the brevity of the career and the fact that the sport is so brutal allowed me to at least pitch a frame to the players that everybody could buy into. And frankly, I would never do it again. But coming into the job in a war, actually made leadership easier. Mm.
Yeah.
And, you know, the basketball players really haven't been in a war in...
Not like that.
Not like that.
Not like
and
that.
So, you know, when you look at, you know, at the end of the day, I needed to convince, you know, Tom Brady, Drew Brees, and Peyton Manning, you know, to be the named plaintiffs on that lawsuit. You know, I would like to come up with some incredible story about how hard it was. It was harder dealing with them on the order on the sheet.
Yeah.
Make it alphabetical.
And that's what I did. Okay. Of course, I may have promised them something different, but
that is great.
But honestly, getting the three of them around it was easy because none of them wanted to walk back in a locker room.
And that, by the way, again, for the amateur sports fan and reading this book, it's tough. Man, you're reading going, wow, okay, I thought I was cynical, right? And then the fact that it was so easy for the three of them to sign up, and they didn't have to. And you kind of go, okay, I'm feeling slightly better about humanity.
No, we throw around a term a lot. I use in the book, and I don't want anybody to take offense to it. But, you know, when we were trying cases, especially in the U.S. Attorney's Office, man, we always referred to, like, the best cops, the best prosecutors as killers.
Yeah.
They were killers. And Peyton is not a confrontational guy, but he's principled.
Yeah.
And Drew has always had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder.
Yes, because he's little.
And he's principled.
Yeah.
Is that why?
And yeah, he's little. He's more a quarterback.
Yeah.
He's little.
Yeah. And Tom is just, you know, Tom.
He's Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's
awesome.
Come on.
Clone dog and all. Clone dog and all. Oh, and heartbeat. We'd all arm wrestle for him. Okay, Scott?
All right, I have a question about Turf Wars.
Yep.
The book. So, commissioners. Commissioners, we have an idea of a commissioner, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, David Stern. I mean, we're talking about all-powerful commissioner, Faye Vinson, A. Bartlett Giamatti. He bans Pete Rose. People who do things for the good of the game. Okay? That's the sort of storybook and archetypical idea of a commissioner.
The mythology.
Exactly. So after... Ray Rice, I actually wrote a cover story for SI called The Incredible Shrinking Commissioner about Roger.
Wow.
So, I talked to Paul Tagliabue, who we all know just passed away.
God bless.
I talked to Faye Vinson. I talked to David Stern. And my question is, I think because the NFL is so strong and so culturally prominent, everybody simply thinks he's powerful.
Yeah.
So my question is Roger Goodell really strong or is he really weak?
Wow.
Okay, let's just, shout out for Scott, who has the best question of the evening. He is. Man.
Slap the field.
Scott, good job.
Like Dick Trickle at the back of the NASCAR race.
I need another beer.
Can we go back to high school football?
I'm sorry. It's called Turf Wars.
I think there's an evolution of Roger. And I think when Roger came into the National Football League in 2007... when he took over, I think he ran on the platform of being the anti-Paul Tagliabue.
Bad cop.
Right. Bad cop. I'm going to let the owners make the decisions. Yeah. I'm not going to run the league sort of in an imperious way.
Right.
And then that evolution over time, I think, has been Roger realizing that the owners, left to their own devices, will drive this happy train, like, right off a cliff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Ray Rice and frankly, Bounty... were the two, and I think we met when you wrote that story about the shrinking commissioner. Mm-hmm. I think Roger was trying to make as many people happy as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
when we say people, the ownership.
Yeah, just the owners. Yeah. I'm sorry.
As many owners.
Just the owners.
But for to maintain his standing,
power,
essentially. Because if you lose the owners, you're done.
And he has, my job was incredibly complex. I've said this every day, and I mean it today. I would never have Roger's job. Ever. No, the 31 of them are just, they're just monsters, and they're not particularly nice, and they're just mean. And
Dee doesn't really tell things how it is. That's the thing. His book is not full of just one bare-knuckled truth.
It's
after
not like
another.
I've been drowning in Christmas gifts from
31
Mike Brown.
31 Monsters would have been a good title.
That was the alternate title. That was the alternate title. They're just not nice people.
Yeah,
they're just not. And I think Roger.
And he's not an unnice guy.
Roger?
You don't think?
D.
Okay.
I almost worked for Roger.
Oh.
No, I did.
Okay, I want to hear that story.
Yeah, really.
What was the
job?
Wait. No.
He's a nice guy,
and there was an expression.
There was.
I was just
a little closer to the mic there,
I was
David.
About to graduate from American University.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking, I wanted to be a journalist, so I was thinking about that. And I got a phone call one day from a guy named Reggie Roberts, who used to be in the NFL office. He was the NFC, they divided it into conferences. Right. They had an NFC PR guy and an AFC PR, and she was a woman, PR woman. And Reggie said, hey, we're thinking about creating this job, and it's kind of a, you know, we want you to talk to players and kind of get a sense of what they want to do and if there's something they want to do post-career. This was 1987. And we're kind of, you know, we're kind of fleshing it out, and you seem to be a good writer, and, like, you know, you're young, and you can relate to these young guys. And I said, oh, okay. Like, I never had this, never talked about this before with anyone. And I said, well, who would I report to? He said, well, a new guy named Roger Goodell.
Oh!
Who was, like, just, like, the boss of PR at the time. Yeah. So the NFL would be your boss.
Wow.
And so I saw Roger at a Monday night game. And he looked at me, and he goes, I bet you regret that decision, don't you?
Said, no.
It's funny.
No, not really.
I said, no, I love being on this side of the street, actually.
Not really.
Actually much better. But he was right. I could have worked for him. I'd have a cushy, I'd be making a lot more money, that's for sure.
He can be charming.
Yeah.
He's incredibly bright. But he can be just absolutely granite at a time when you don't need to be granite.
Yeah. Got it.
And,
yeah,
you know, we went through Bounty Gate, Deflate Gate, Ray Rice,
Michael Vick,
Kaepernick, Michael Vick was before me.
Okay.
But for almost 9 years in a row, we had a pending federal case going against the National Football League.
Right.
And I would say that Rogers' worst characteristic is once the train left the station, he can never back the train up.
Yeah.
And so you end up getting into what I would consider at times just these incredibly inane fights for no reason.
Yeah.
And he would just become so rigid. And I think one time I joked that he had the National Football League as a logo on his chest, and he did not laugh. I thought it was somewhat funny, but also I think it's
so great.
Might be true.
All right. Yeah. Anybody in our wonderful audience here, including former legal advisors, consultants,
big-time attorneys,
any
questions?
Some
heavy hitters.
They're going to say nothing.
If you, of course they're not. They're all looking down at their cell phones now.
Oh no, that's all in the vault.
Okay, good.
Yeah, no.
All right, let's get you out with this before we subject you to 60 seconds more.
Oh,
no, okay, maybe we won't. So the subtitle on the book, Turf Wars, is The Fight for the Soul of America's Game. Where is that soul today, and where's it going?
I think the soul of all sport is the players. And it is the thing that unites us. It becomes the town square that we all kind of grew up with. I mean, we all have this connection with sport, you know, certainly on a professional level, and you've all covered it deeper than I ever will. But I think the real heart tug of sport is we all hearken back to that moment, you know, and it might have been high school, it might have been Little League, but that convening power of sport I think is incredibly beautiful until it gets corrupted. And I think that the only place that I found it was preserving sort of the players' way of thinking and the way that they approach the game,
keeping them alive, kind
sometimes
of a big
against
deal.
Their own,
yes,
their own will,
yeah,
and
yeah.
And I guess the last thing I would say about that is, having gone through Anthem and Kaepernick, having represented both the players and Colin, the beautiful thing about the town square is that whenever you get there for the game, it doesn't matter what job you have. It doesn't matter whether you're a butcher, plumber, CEO, that town square for sport brings everybody together at a leveler moment,
yes,
where you just decide to park. You decide to park everything that separates you, but you're bringing everything together that unites you.
Yeah.
And Anthem to me was the league at its worst, because I couldn't understand why the National Football League, for the first time in my career, allowed someone, in this case the president, to intervene with their business. and for the people who covered sport longer than I have, man, the league puts everybody in the ground.
Right.
Who challenges the league. I mean, you know, we remember the USFL. We remember the World Football League. Yep. Even if you go back to the...
AFL.
AFL. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, the AFL and the NFL merge.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
the NFL is like, whoa, 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 this AFL thing is a threat to
right.
us.
Right.
And, you know, when the NFL gets regulated to Sunday, you know, because that was the last stand for college football. They said, hey, you're going to get this antitrust exemption, but the one thing you are not going to be allowed to do is play on Saturday.
Right.
We're going to relegate you guys to church day.
Yeah. Right, right. That's right.
And the league's response to that was, oh, champ, we'll take Sunday.
Yeah. Right.
And we'll take Monday.
Yeah. Right.
And we'll take Thursday.
Right.
And as soon as the college season is over,
we'll take Saturday.
They take Saturday. So I couldn't understand for almost about 3 months why they would let someone pit something against football.
Yeah.
And then I realized that it was just their politics.
Right.
And so, you know, for me, I think looking at this sort of thing in sport, I never wanted to write a football book. You know, whether it's race or gender or power, those are everyday things in America that when we get to the town hall, man, we don't forget they're there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We just decide that we're going to focus on the things that
right.
bring us together.
Right. Right.
What did you learn about yourself?
I did learn that I was not indestructible. I learned that at the end of the day...
I should look at your wife as I say that.
Yeah, yeah. She's like, yeah. I lose every fight at home. I go 50-50 everywhere else.
If you're smart, you lose every fight at home.
Yeah. Yeah, 34 years, pal. Yeah. I learned I wasn't indestructible. I also learned that probably running a labor union is the hardest job on the face of the planet. I wish that I had been a little bit more judicious is probably the wrong word. I wish I would have looked at the 15 years as a against a backdrop of, you know, 50 years or 100 years of union battles.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Because I would have probably been a little bit less strident and a little bit less zero-sum. But it's also the only way I know how to play the game.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Awesome. What's next?
I teach now. So I teach at Pepperdine. I'm likely to teach at Georgetown in the spring.
Awesome.
And then I'm on the road talking about Turf Wars.
Excellent. Turf Wars, awesome book. Thank you so much for the work you've done. Again, keeping the players alive, that's my thing. The mom and me just says keep them alive. It's a really, really remarkable book. It is the ultimate insider's guide to what went on at really, really critical times for the league. So thank you for doing it. Thank you for being with us. Ronnie, who is still holding court over there, by the way.
Ronnie
never leaves that seat. Lisa, thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We are back in 2 weeks. Thomas Dann, great book. Murder in Memphis, really wonderful. But everybody at Caddies, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you,
and if you're in the first 20, you get a free book. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Clyde.
Thank you.